I want to start at the end of the gospel because John is one of those books that he tells us at the end of the story, like, this is why I wrote this book. And so we're going to read the purpose statement of John, which is in chapter 20, and then we'll back up to chapter 11, which is kind of where we're at in our journey through John. The good news is, once we finish this segment of the Belief Project, we'll be more than halfway through the book. So I guess that's good news, that we're at least around the corner. So again, from the best friend of Jesus, he tells us what's on the test at the end of the book, like, this is why I wrote the book. So he kind of gives us the open book answers at the end of his gospel. And then we're going to do a little quiz together based on what John says here. So we'll leave the text up after I finish reading it, and we'll do a little quiz together, an open book quiz to bring us up to speed on the Belief Project. So John writes in chapter 20, verse 30, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written," so these signs are written, "so that," and here's our purpose statement, "that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." So that's why we entitled this the Belief Project, because everything that John writes in his gospel is centered around this idea of generating belief. So let's have a little open book quiz, okay? So I'll just ask some random questions about John's purpose, and hopefully, again, they'll be simple enough for us to know the answers. So John has a name for the word miracles that he uses here. So I'm going to give you some multiple choice answers here. Wait till I'm done before you answer out loud, because I know it's right on the tip of your tongue. For some of you, just want to scream it out right now. So abstain, like, use patience in this moment. So miracles, John has a name for miracles here. So we'll do this. A, I don't know, supernatural events. B, does he call miracles a phenomena? C, does he call miracles, I don't know, an Auburn national championship? Or D, does he call miracles a sign? You can answer now. D, sign, okay? So when he uses the word sign, he's talking about these miracles that are in the Gospel of John. We said off and on throughout the series that signs point to something. That's the purpose of a sign, is to point something out. So if you're riding down the interstate and you see exit 42, there's food at that exit, like, you know, like, this is what's at exit 42. The sign tells you that. If you walk up in someone's yard and the sign says, beware of dog, like, you should know they probably have a vicious dog that you should be aware of. If you are looking for a place to eat and you see a sign, if you see big golden arches, like, you don't show up at a big golden arches restaurant. Is that a fair name for the big golden arches restaurant? You don't show up at this fast food establishment and order something that you expect to find somewhere else. Like, you don't go and order a nice steak dinner at where the golden arches are at McDonald's. They look at you like, you're at McDonald's. Like, you want a Big Mac or a double cheeseburger? Like, we don't serve prime rib here. Like, must have misread the sign. Like, you have to know where you're going into. Signs point to something. If you need to go to the restroom, like, you need to make sure that you see the right sign, that you go in the right spot. You know, if you're a man, you don't walk in the women's restroom and look around like, what's going on in here? Why are all these ladies in here? You'd be like, look at the sign. The sign says this is a women's bathroom. So look at the sign. Signs point to something. Signs are not pointing to the sign. Signs are pointing to something bigger than the sign, something besides the sign. So John says that the miracles that happen in his gospel are signs that are pointing to Jesus. So, true or false question, based on the purpose statement of John, every miracle that Jesus ever performed is recorded in John's gospel. False. John says, I've only given you a glimpse of these miracles, of these signs. I've just given you this much, only a select few, because I have a select specific purpose in mind when I record these particular events, which leads us to our next open book quiz question. John recorded these signs in order to generate what? A, we'll say A, belief, B, confusion, C, doubt, or D, I don't know, social media likes. Like, why did he record these? To generate what? Belief. I've written these things not to give thumbs up, not to see how many likes I can get on social media, not to confuse you, not to generate doubt. I have given you these signs in order to generate belief, that you may believe, John says. So every week, every story, every teaching in John's Gospels is to generate belief. He leaves us at this crossroads every week. Will I believe or will I turn in unbelief? Belief or unbelief? His goal is to generate belief. And what is this belief? John's goal is to promote the belief that Jesus is what? A, the Son of God, B, the Messiah, the Christ, or C, just another religious guru. A and B, right? That Jesus is the Son of God, that Jesus is the Christ. John says, this is why I have written my gospel. The signs point to who Jesus is. That he's the Son of God. That he is the Messiah. That's the reason I've written. That's the reason I'm generating to believe. That's the reason I'm giving you these signs, is to point to who Jesus is, and we could say to who Jesus is not. Who he is and who he's not. So, in John's gospel then, belief generates, based on his purpose statement, belief generates what? Health? No. Wealth? No. Since we're going with that theme, we'll say C is big hair. It's not to generate health or wealth or big hair. That's sometimes what you see with that belief, for whatever reason. But the fourth answer is that it may generate what? Life. Believe so that you might live. So that you may believe, and by believing, you may have life, eternal life. So this is John's position throughout his entire gospel. Belief in Jesus equals life. Not believing in Jesus equals death. Life or death, belief or unbelief. That is the entire premise of why John has written his gospel. Now I'm going to give a bonus question here. You win a round of applause if you get this one, because it's not in the purpose statement. And I probably have mentioned it a couple of times, but I know we've been in the Belief Project for a long time. How many specific signs, miracles, does John record in his gospel? Anyone know how many? I'll give you a hint. It's the number of completion in the Bible. Seven. Seven signs in John's gospel. You may or may not realize this. We've already been through six of them. Today we're going to begin the final sign, which is the raising of Lazarus from the dead, the most climactic sign of them all. But I'll just kind of go through them quickly. The first sign was in chapter 2 when Jesus turned water into wine at the wedding in Cana of Galilee. The second sign was in chapter 4 when Jesus healed this official son long distance. Remember, the guy came to him and said, "Heal my son, like you don't even have to come." So there's this kind of this long distance cure that takes place. Jesus heals at a distance. Like, that brings a whole new meaning to long distance, right? Like, can you hear me now, right? So heals the guy long distance. Chapter 5, he heals the guy that's been laying by the pool of Bethesda for 38 years. Like, this guy's been laying at the pool longer than Ashley has been alive. Not me, but Ash has been alive. He's been laying by this pool, and Jesus heals him. In chapter 6, Jesus feeds 5,000 men plus women and children with basically brown and serve rolls and a can of sardines, right? Jesus performs this feeding of the multitude. Also in chapter 6, Jesus walks on the water after his disciples have been like rowing for 3 or 4 miles in the middle of the night in the storm. Jesus just comes walking up. Like, that had to be so frustrating for the disciples. Like, we have been out here toiling along, trying to make headway, and Jesus comes walking up on the water. And then the rest of the miracle that we sometimes miss is, like, Jesus gets in the boat, and then the text says immediately they were at the shore. Like, there's that miracle that happens in the miracle. So they've been rowing for 3 or 4 hours. Jesus strolls up, walking on the water, gets in the boat, and then they're immediately at the dock. Like, Jesus, like, couldn't you have walked out here like 10 minutes into this thing? And so there's that miracle. And then the miracle of chapter 9, the sixth sign, is that Jesus healed the man that was born blind. If you remember that story, it's one of the last ones that we were in. A fascinating story. The religious leaders are like, is this the guy that's been blind from birth? And He's like, I'm him. He's like, go get his parents and ask him, make sure. And he's like, I am the guy. And then they start having this conversation about the blind dude in the blind dude's presence. And the guy's like saying things in the text. It's like, hey, hello, I'm not deaf. I'm just blind. I can hear you. Like, if you want to know if I'm the guy, I'm the guy. You don't have to ask my parents. Like, I'm the guy. And then he like sarcastically asked the religious leaders, like, do you want to know all these answers because you too want to believe? And they're all like, no, we don't want to believe. So these are the signs that John has been taking us through. And then we reach the climactic sign in chapter 11, which is the raising of Lazarus. So all of these signs, they speak of the absolute authority of Jesus over all of life. Over bread, over water, over wine, over disease, over blindness, over time and space. Jesus is Lord over everything. And there's been this natural progression taking place in the unpacking of these signs. First, he turns water to wine. There's a long-distance cure. He heals a man crippled for 38 years. He feeds a multitude. He walks on water. He heals a guy blind from birth. So you can see this progression that's taking place until we reach chapter 11. The climax in the Lazarus story where Jesus reaches into the realm of death itself and works a miracle. I can see it's one thing to like turn water to wine. It's another thing to reach into the realm of death and restore life to a dead person. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to go kind of behind the scenes today. We're going to do a VH1. Remember the old VH1, Behind the Music? We're going to go behind the scenes today. And we're going to look at the story of Bethany. We're going to set the stage for kind of the grand finale next week when Jesus calls Lazarus back from the dead. So let's pick up in chapter 11, verse 1. We're going to walk through this text together and then bring out a couple of important things for our everyday life at the end of the text. Now, a certain man was ill. That doesn't mean like he was feisty and people was getting on his nerves and he was snapping at everybody. That means he was sick. A certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. Verse 2 tells us a little bit about this. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So we set the stage again. Lazarus is sick. We learn later he was deathly sick. Lazarus, maybe I'll just call him Larry, it seems easier. Lazarus, Mary, that's the common, I just realized what happened. I combined Lazarus and Mary, which equals Larry. Lazarus and Mary and Martha, close friends of Jesus. Matter of fact, Mary and Martha, Luke 10, we referred to them a few weeks ago. They're the Luke 10 sisters, one sitting at the feet of Jesus, one scurrying around in the house trying to get ready for Jesus, and Jesus gives the rebuke to Martha, like, sit down and listen, like, I'm here, just like, stop scurrying around and sit down and listen. That's the Mary and Martha we're talking about. We've read the reference here, you can read it in other Gospels. Mary, that is not the mother of Jesus, is Mary of Mary and Martha, that she would later anoint the feet of Jesus with oil and wipe his feet with her hair, which is this sign of extravagant worship in that day, and we'll get to that later. So that's the Mary and Martha that we're talking about. They're the best friends of Jesus. They are people that Jesus loved deeply. Now, this is important to know as we walk through this text. These are people that Jesus loved deeply. Now, this is a rabbit trail I don't have time to chase. But the fact that Jesus had people in his life that he loved deeply, that were friends of his, says something about our need to have people in our lives that we love deeply, that we're on the journey with. Like, you're not in this thing alone. Like, the Son of God himself had friends that he loved deeply and spent time with and hung out in their home and built relationship with. And so it's these people, the best friends of Jesus, that they're facing a death and life situation. Verse 3, so the sister sent to him saying, Lord, look how they phrase this, he whom you love is ill. Jesus, your best friend Lazarus, the person that you love, is sick. So there's this 911 call to Jesus. because crisis has happened. Their life is in disarray. Now, what are they assuming here? They're assuming that Jesus will pack up his bags and come. They know Jesus. Jesus is compassionate. Jesus is a healer. They've watched Jesus heal people. They've watched Jesus heal strangers. They've watched Jesus heal lepers. They've watched Jesus heal people that other people ignored. They know who Jesus is. He is their friend. He's full of compassion. He's a healer. And they are facing this crisis in their lives, this situation where sickness has entered the picture and worry has entered the picture. Like that's common. Twins, right? That when the people that we love grow sick, particularly in unknown situations, sickness that could lead to death, the twin sibling of sickness for us is worry. It's concern, deep, grave concern. And so their response here is natural. Send word to Jesus. Like get the 911 call to Jesus because they've heard difficult words. These are difficult words to hear that will set your life in disarray. I'm not talking about WebMD where you've got the sniffles and everything you research on WebMD comes back that you're about to die, right? No matter what's going on, you read what's on the internet, you're about to die. I'm not talking about WebMD. I'm talking about they have gotten word that Lazarus is about to die. They're not Googling it. It's not up for grabs. They have heard the words. If he doesn't get better, he will die. They've heard the words. You know what those words are? We've all lived through them. We've heard the words. It's cancer, right? It's back. We've been through that. We've all faced that. You've heard, if you've lived for any length of time, people that you've loved or family or friends, you've heard the words. There's nothing we can do. Like that's the words that Mary and Martha and Lazarus have heard. They've heard the words that bring fear and dread and worry into our hearts because sickness and disease and crisis is a reality that each one of us face. You know someone who's going through it right now. You know someone that's been through it. You know children, you know family, you know friends that have heard the words that none of us want to hear. That's where Mary and Martha and Lazarus are. And so they did the natural thing, didn't they? They sent word to Jesus. They did the natural thing. They prayed. They asked for prayer. They said, put us on the prayer list. They said, whatever way that you pray, like pray for us. They called the pastor. Like they did what was natural. They did the natural thing when sickness enters the picture, sickness that will lead to death. They are concerned and they're worried and they send word to Jesus. Come, the one that you love is sick. Verse 4. But when Jesus heard it, he said, this illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Jesus does not hop in an Uber. He doesn't call for a cab. He doesn't say we got to get to Bethany as quickly as possible. As a matter of fact, when we read the words of Jesus, you can almost hear a sigh of relief because of what Jesus says. Jesus says the end result of this is not death. It's the glory of God, the glory of the Son of God. Like, those are good words that they want to hear when Lazarus is dying. They hear, like, this is not going to end in death. It's going to end in the glory of God. And so the natural response to that is like, Lazarus is going to get better. Lazarus is going to be healed. God's going to be glorified. That's what you would think that was taking place. Look at verse 5. Again, reinforces this idea. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Jesus loved them. Jesus loved Martha. Jesus loved Mary. Jesus loved Lazarus. So healing makes sense. But as the story takes an unexpected turn, it's important to remember what happens in this story. Don't miss this. What happens in this story is motivated by the love that Jesus has for this family. John brings it back to us. He said it in the beginning. He says it again in verse 5. Like, don't forget while I'm telling you this story that Jesus loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And we know why he has to remind us, because we know the whole story. But he reminds us again in verse 5, don't forget while I'm telling you the story. Jesus loved him, because what I'm about to tell you doesn't seem like he might have loved him. So he gives us a little bit of a wake-up call. Remember that what's about to take place is motivated by the love that Jesus has for this family, because you might question it from a human perspective. Verse 6, so when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. No taxi. No, we got to get to Bethany. Jesus stayed 2 days longer. He's not in a rush. Now, this kind of reinforces the idea that if we're just reading this along and don't know the story, like, kind of reinforces the idea everything's going to be okay. I mean, Jesus kept hanging out, right? 2 more days. After 2 days, verse 7. Then, after this, he said to his disciples, let us go to Judea again. So after 2 days, Jesus is like, now it's time. Pack the bags. Let's go to Judea. But there's a problem here. And we see the problem in verse 8. The disciples said to him, Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you, and you're going to go there again? So this is a flashback moment for us. If we were to go back into the Belief Project and kind of some of the previous chapters we were in, if you recall what was happening, Jesus upset some powerful people in Judea the last time he was there. He claimed to be God, and they picked up rocks and said, we're going to take this guy out. And Jesus disappeared. And so now the disciples are saying, Jesus, is this the best move? Pack the bags up and go back? Remember the last time we were there? They were ready to stone us, to kill us. Is this really the best move? And then Jesus preaches this kind of mini sermon to them in verse 9 and 10. Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in a day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of the world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him. And we say, along with the disciples, what? Jesus gives us a little bit of a sermon on light and darkness, and there is some confusion on the exact meaning of what Jesus is saying here, but here's the gist of it. Don't stumble around in the darkness. Now, if you know darkness in John's gospel, we've referred to this a few times. The idea of darkness in John's gospel is associated with the idea of unbelief, the idea of fear, the idea of uncertainty. So Jesus is saying, like, don't be stumbling around in the darkness and unbelief and fear and uncertainty when you are living in the presence of the light. Don't be consumed with the night in the presence of the light. That rhymed. Don't be consumed and stumbling around in the darkness of unbelief when you are living in the presence of the light. What is Jesus saying? It's going to be okay because you're in my presence. I'm here with you. Man, it's easy to get distracted by the night instead of living in the light. And that's what's happening with the disciples. The disciples don't get it, like they often did not. And so verse 11, after saying these things, he said to them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him. Again, confusing here. Lazarus is asleep, and we're going to go wake him up. Stop focusing on the darkness, Jesus says. But what did Jesus just say? He's like, Lazarus is asleep. So that's what the disciples naturally hear. The disciples said to him, verse 12, Lord, if he's fallen asleep, he will recover. The disciples, like, Jesus, if he's asleep, let him wake up on his own. Why do we have to be there? Rocks hurt. I don't want to go back in there. They tried to stone us the last time we were there. If he's asleep, let him wake up. He's going to be okay. Jesus says again, you're missing the point. Verse 13. Now Jesus had spoken of his, what? Death. But they thought that he meant taking rest in sleep. Then Jesus told them plainly, I like that phrase, Lazarus has died. And for your sake, I'm glad that I was not there, so that, Here we go. Purpose. You may what? Believe. But let us go to him. Jesus goes into plain speaking. Not many of us, maybe a few of you, that were around when President Harry Truman was alive. Anybody alive when Harry Truman was around? And so if you know anything about American history, you know Harry Truman was a very plain speaking person. As a matter of fact, when Truman stepped away from the White House and moved back to Missouri, a Washington columnist, Mary McGrory, said this: since Harry Truman left town, almost nobody has spoken his mind. Truman took the tradition of plain speaking back to Missouri with him. There was an author that named Merle Miller that took that phrase and turned it into a book, basically a oral book that you can listen to on the plain speaking of Harry Truman. He was a plain speaking man. And Jesus speaks plainly here. Lazarus is dead. Now, I kind of cracked up when I was reading this, Jesus' words speaking plainly, Lazarus is dead, because there's kind of this funny story that circulates in my family. My grandmother on my mother's side, that's been passed away for a decade plus, was a very plain speaking woman, very southern woman, and late in her life, she was going through some dementia and things like that, and she had a sibling that had been sick for a really long time and was always on the verge of death, it seemed like, and she finally died. Her name was Burton, a good southern name of a lady, Burton. And so my Mamaw Minor was her name, what we called her, Mamaw Minor, and she was just everything you would picture as Mamaw Minor being, this round, jolly, amazing cook, slobbery, kissing, bear-hugging Mamaw. And so when, and my mom is like the opposite of that in every way. And so when Bert's mom was at the house and the phone rings, and my mom's name is Sandra K. Hudson now, obviously. Sandy, a lot of people call her. But my mamaw, being the southern drawl woman that she is, called her Sanner. S-A-N-N-E-R, Sanner. And so mamaw picks up the phone, and the only thing she hears on the other end is my mamaw's voice saying, "Sanner, Burton died." That's it. "Sanner, Burton died." So that's not how you want your death announced to the family. And so that's plain speaking. That's what happened right here. Lazarus died, right? I don't know if Jesus spoke with a southern accent, but in this case, he speaks plainly to the disciples. "Sanner, Burton's dead," right? Burton died. Disciples, Lazarus died. He's dead. Plain speaking. Then the rest of what Jesus says. "And for your sake," I'm glad I wasn't there. Because there's a bigger purpose. There's a higher purpose to enhance your belief. God is at work even when you do not see it and can't comprehend it. Verse 16. Now, there's something about Thomas I like. I know we always like beating up on Thomas as the doubter, but I think Thomas was a realist more than a doubter. So Thomas, called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us also go that we may die with him." Like, Thomas is the realist. Like, "Let's go, fellas, pack the bags. We might as well go and die. Let's go with him." Like, we don't get tone in the scripture. We don't know if this is sarcasm or realism with courage. But either way, Tommy always gets the bad rap. He's always like doubting Thomas. We've labeled him for all of eternity. I think he was just a realist, right? Even at the end of the Jesus story, he's like, "I want to put my fingers in his hands and feet." Like, every one of us would have been that way. Talking about, I think he was a realist. As a matter of fact, we'll get to it eventually. I may have lost half my mind by the time we get to the end of John. But eventually we'll get there where Thomas says, "My Lord and my God." Like, he makes one of the biggest professions of Jesus. I think he was a realist. And in this moment, we see it. We don't know if it's cloaked with sarcasm, or we don't know if he's just being a realist with courage. But either way, Tommy's getting the bad rap. But he's saying, smack in the middle of trouble, "We're going to go visit a dead man?" There's something bigger happening, isn't there? So that sets the stage for us. Let me give you a couple of important takeaways from this initial part of the story that we can't miss before we get to the actual sign next Sunday. Listen to these things carefully. Things in life are not always as they seem. Things in life are not always as they seem because I don't see the full picture. These two statements go hand in hand. Things in life are not always as they seem, as they appear, because I don't get to see the full picture. Lazarus is sick. It's not looking good. But we know Jesus. He's the divine healer. He's healed lots of people. He's healed strangers. And Jesus loves us. He has compassion. He has our back. Get word to Jesus. He'll come. Everything will be okay. But things are not always as they seem. The disciples. Lazarus is sick. Jesus says, don't worry about it. It's not unto death. It's for God's glory. Because they wanted to kill us up in that place. Jesus, we're heading to Judea. Why? Because Lazarus is asleep and I need to go wake him up. Jesus, he's asleep. Let him wake up. Jesus, he's not asleep, guys. He's dead. And we're going to go wake him up. Things are not always as they seem. Things are not always as they seem. And if you have lived any life, you have experienced this reality. That my plan does not always equal God's plan. That God does not always do what I expect, what I want, what I think is best. And the reality of life is that innocent people suffer, that tragedy occurs, that people die unexpectedly, that abuse happens, that relationships collapse, that people sin, right? To put it very practically, like if you live life long enough, your cat's going to get run over, right? That's the reality of life. Stuff happens. Now, Mary and Martha did not expect Lazarus to die. They expected Jesus to drop everything, to show up and to heal him. The disciples did not expect Lazarus to die or to have to return to a place that they felt very unsafe. But sometimes things just don't go like we want. Things just don't go like we expect. And as a result, what happens? Fear and grief are deep emotions that we face. They faced it. Fear and grief. God doesn't pull us away from these emotions. God doesn't bail us out of these emotions. God doesn't deliver us from these emotions. Instead, He comes to us in these seasons. The man of sorrow, next week we'll see it. Jesus goes to where they're at and what does Jesus do? He weeps with them. Shortest verse in all the Bible. Jesus wept. He came to them in their fear. He came to them in their grief. He comes to us in those seasons and He weeps alongside. He weeps alongside the sisters. He walks into the danger zone with the disciples. Things are not always as they seem. Because I don't see the full picture. But God is in absolute sovereign control. And He is good. He is working a plan, always working a plan that is bigger and better than we can see in the moment. So when Jesus speaks the words, this illness does not lead to death. It is for God's glory. He's not saying, look, Lazarus is not going to die. What He's saying is, there is a bigger picture. There is something that you can't see. There's something you can't grasp. And from all appearances, it's going to look like Lazarus died. But I'm here to tell you, Jesus says, that's not the end of the story. This thing doesn't end in death. It ends in God's glory. And I want to encourage you, follower of Jesus, for the follower of Jesus, this, whatever it is that you fill in the blank, this struggle, this difficulty, this disarray, this cancer, this sickness, this loss, it doesn't end in death. It ends in God's glory. There's life on the other side. Life awaits. And it may not look like what it looked like for Lazarus. It may not be God calling you up out of the tomb. You may go through the grief. You may go through the sorrow. You're going to go through the pain. You're going to go through the hurt. But that's not the end of the story. For the follower of Jesus, it doesn't end in death. It ends in His glory. So let's do this one because this is so important. We'll just end with this one. Things are not always as they seem or appear. I don't see the full picture. God's timing is not always my timing. I don't see the eternal picture. God's timing's not always my timing. Don't you find it odd that Jesus stays two more days? Like if we bump ahead to verse 17, we find out next week that Lazarus has been dead for 4 days when Jesus gets there. Jesus stayed behind two more. And by the time he gets there, Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. So the natural question is, like, why did Jesus wait? Why did Jesus not get there and heal Lazarus? Is Jesus just thoughtless? Like, don't forget, we know the final chapter here. We know that Lazarus gets raised back to life. Jesus is going to perform his greatest miracle to date. He's going to reveal his power over death. But in the moment, listen, in the moment, God's timing seems wrong. God's timing seems unfair. God's timing seems calloused. You know why? Because we tend to interpret any delay in help as cruel, don't we? Any delay. As we're living life and disarray happens and difficulty happens and sickness happens and we begin to pray and cry out and call the prayer chain and call the pastor, we interpret any delay in help as cruel. Why? Because our natural desire is to avoid pain, to avoid sickness, to avoid hurt. And so a delay seems to be just cruel because we're not avoiding pain. And the second reason is because our demand for immediate action, we have this demand for immediate action when it comes to time. We want to be healed now. We want it to take place now. We want prayer to happen and to be heard, right? I mean, think about how impatient we get on just little stuff like this. Like, you go to the doctor and they're like, we're going to call you at 1 p.m. and it's 4 p.m. You're like, they haven't even called. That doctor could care less about me. They got me waiting. I've been waiting for 2 hours. Are you kidding me? They said they were going to call at 1 o'clock. Actually, 1 and 4, that'd be 3 hours. I've been waiting for 3 hours and they haven't even called. Like, that's us, right? Any delay comes across as calloused, comes across as heartless. Anything outside of my perspective of proper timing seems inappropriate. It seems wrong. Here's the way I picture it. I have to ride, driving through a big city or whatever, and you come on some traffic jam. And with technology today, you can kind of see from whatever app, like, what's ahead of you? Like, how long is this traffic jam going to be? Like, if you're using Waze or whatever, like, how long is the red line? You're, like, scrolling down your phone. Like, how long is this red line going to be before I get to the end of the traffic jam? So there's the perspective of sitting on this side of the interstate in the traffic jam, and then I've been on this side of the interstate going this direction. You know what I'm talking about? And there's no traffic jam on my side. And so I'm cruising along, and on the other side, it's nothing but stop traffic for miles and miles and miles. And you reach that point when you get near the end of where the traffic jam starts, where you're just like talking to those people in your mind or out loud if you're crazy. Like just saying, like, you have no idea what's waiting ahead of you. You got like 3 hours. I wish I could tell you. You got like 3 hours. Truck driver knows what I'm talking about right here. Like, you got like 3 hours. Like, when you're on this side of the interstate, or when you're looking at the app, you can see what's going on. But when you're sitting in the traffic jam, all you can see around you is the cars. All you can see is that you're not moving. All you can see is a human perspective of a traffic jam. And as we live life and the traffic jams of life come along, our tendency is to only see right in front of us, to see life from a human perspective, to only see the traffic jam that we're in, because we can't see from the other side and we can't see the big picture from the helicopter of what's lying ahead of us. All we can see is the bumper-to-bumper taillights right in front of us, and that's how we tend to live life. Because we can only see from a temporary perspective. And God's timing is not always my timing. I can only see the traffic jams in life. Like, we've been there. Some of you have prayed for a child, and it seems like God doesn't hear an answer. Some of you have prayed for healing, and it hasn't happened. You've prayed for answers, and you haven't gotten them. You have prayed for a broken relationship, and it has not been mended. You have prayed for a spouse who is away from God, and it seems like God doesn't even hear, and they have no interest in spiritual things. You have prayed and prayed and prayed, and you're tired of praying, and it feels like sometimes God is not listening. God is not responding. Is God even there? Is he calloused? Does he even care? Because life problems tend to ravage our perspective. It distorts the bigger picture. It distorts the purpose, because life's problems, listen, are intended to enhance our faith, to push us to Jesus. God's timing is not always our timing. And we serve a God who is so sovereign that he will not be manipulated into our preferred, restricted, temporary timetables. You know why? Because he's operating beyond the here and now. He's operating on the eternal timetable. He is preparing us for life beyond the moment. He is preparing us for life beyond the temporary, life beyond the traffic jam. You know what this delay does? This delay ensures that God is glorified. Let me show you how. We'll touch on it again next week. When Jesus gets there, Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. You know what that means in that culture? In that culture, they believe that the soul, the spirit, hovered around the body for guess how long? 3 days. And then it was gone. When does Jesus show up? Day 4. When Jesus yelled the name of Lazarus, and Lazarus came walking out of that tomb, Jesus did not want there to be any doubt what had happened. He didn't want there to be questions of, well, Lazarus just resuscitated. It's day 2. It's day 3. The spirit was still lingering around, and Lazarus just caught his breath and came walking out of the tomb. When Jesus showed up on day 4, there was no doubt. Lazarus was dead and gone. They were weeping and mourning and grieving, and Jesus shows up, calls him out, and he comes walking out of the tomb. And guess who's glorified? God. God is glorified because there's no question. So listen to me, child of God. God's timing is not always my timing. Delays are for our ultimate good and for his ultimate glory. So here's our question. Will I trust God when I can't hear him? Will I trust him? Will I trust him in the delay? Will I trust him in the middle of the grief? Will I trust him when fear plagues my soul? Will I trust him in the loneliness? Will I trust him when things don't seem to be getting better? Will I trust him when that spouse has no spiritual awareness about them and I'm pleading God for just save the soul of my husband, of my wife? Will I trust him? Will I trust him when my kid is away from God? Will I trust him when my relationship is severed? Will I trust him when things don't seem to keep getting better at work? Will I trust him when my finances are insecure? Will I trust God even when I can't hear him? Here's your encouragement. It is in those places that he most often comes to us. Jesus wept. It is in those places where Jesus comes to us and weeps and mourns and grieves alongside of us. It is in those places where Jesus steps into our tragedy, listen, so that we might experience his triumph. Man, this story ends well, doesn't it? Tragedy turned triumph. I mean, like, he calls him up out of the grave, dead man walking. We know how the story ends. It ends not in tragedy, but in triumph. Not in defeat, but in victory. Not in death, but in life. And I want to tell you, that is how your story ends. If you're a follower of Jesus, that's how your story ends. Whatever you're facing right now, God's in control. God is good. God will be glorified. So God can be trusted. He can be trusted. You may not feel it. You may not sense it. You may feel like the timeline is not your timeline and it feels endless. And is this ever going to happen? And I want to encourage you, even if it doesn't happen, God can be trusted because He is good and He sees the big picture and He's in eternal control. Trust Him. Lean into Him. I want to give you the freedom today to mourn and grieve and have fear and uncertainty and to cry out to God and to have doubts. Like, there's freedom to have those emotions as a human because Jesus steps into that space. Like, don't think it's not okay to grieve. Grieve. Jesus will weep alongside you. John 11 gets our eyes up. It elevates our perspective. It raises our eyes above the traffic jam, above ground level, because the death of Lazarus was not the end of the story. The grief of Mary and Martha is not the end of the story. The fear of the disciples losing their lives is not the end of the story. And it is not the end of your story. God is writing a bigger story. A story that transcends a moment in time. A story that transcends grief. A story that transcends fear. A story that transcends questions and sickness and uncertainty and frustration and suffering. A story that transcends death itself. He's already written that final chapter. And He invites us in. So let me read these verses for next week. And we're done, because this is the heart of the Lazarus story. John 11, 25. This is Martha comes to Jesus, and she's ticked, like, why weren't you here? And if you'd been here, you wouldn't have died. Look what Jesus says to her. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. I am. I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever, here's our word, believes in me, though he, what? Though he die, yet shall he live. Death's not the end of the story. Though you die physically, though big D death invades our space, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. And then he puts the question to Martha and he puts it to all of us. Will you, do you believe this? Will you believe this? When you're in the traffic jam and you can't see and it doesn't seem like God can't hear and that spouse has not come to Jesus and the child is away from God or you lost the loved one or the diagnosis from the doctor is not good or the cancer has hit, or it's come back, or it seems unjust or unfair. Like, Jesus puts the question to us, I am the resurrection and life. Will you believe that? Will you trust me in that moment? You see, God was going to be glorified whether Jesus called Lazarus from the tomb or not. You get that? But he puts on display God's glory in that moment so that they might see and so that we might see in 2019, reading from this text, that he is the resurrection and the life. And he reaches into whatever death has killed in your life and he brings it to life. He resuscitates. And even when little D death gets us all and we're on our deathbed, that's not the end of the story. I am the resurrection and the life, Jesus says. And even if you die, you live if you're a follower of Jesus. We'll get there next Sunday when Jesus calls Lazarus forth. But in the meantime, be reminded, things in life are not always as they seem. We don't see the full picture. Remember, God's timing is not always my timing, because I don't see the eternal picture. But God is sovereign. God is good. God can be trusted. He is the resurrection and the life. And those who believe on Him, they will live.